The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. All this week, NHPR and The Exchange are examining issues affecting the youngest Granite Staters in a series called The First Decade. We're looking at what kids need to build the foundation for success for their own lives and their contributions to society. And toward that goal, one idea keeps coming up. It's the importance of high-quality early education, whether at home, in a preschool setting, or kindergarten. And the learning that needs to take place is about more than just numbers and letters, as Exchange producer Jason Moon found out in his visit to a kindergarten class at Beach Street School in Manchester.
My name is Kristen Barden, and I am a kindergarten teacher at Beach Street School.
So we're going to take attendance and start morning meeting.
Faustina.
Here.
Shakina.
Here.
Amy.
Here.
In many ways, I feel that, you know, kindergarten teachers are like a second parent. We are taking care of their boo-boos. We are helping them when they, you know, have some real struggles at home going on. We are teaching them academically. We're trying to create a whole child. You know, the personalities and the struggles and strengths are all so diverse. So, yeah, we're meeting those needs on a daily basis.
Good morning, Tati. How are you?
Were you sick? No, how come you didn't come to school yesterday?
Because I had a doctor's appointment.
Oh, you had a doctor's appointment. Okay, good. I'm glad that you're not sick. Okay, Sean, let's go find your space. We are putting the days of the week in order, just like the Hungry Caterpillar.
I know what to do.
You know what to do? See, so strategies to help themselves. So rather than me giving them the answer, like, she knows what to do, because we talk all about finding something in the classroom that can help you find a resource or a tool that can help you solve the problem. I have seen the kindergarten standards become more rigorous and demanding, and so I think parents' perception of what kindergarten is maybe a little bit of a misconception, because like 10 years ago when I started, if they knew their alphabet leaving kindergarten, they were on grade level. Well, now they need to be reading multi-sentences in a text. So really, I think that the demands have changed so much.
Faustina, good morning, dear Zoe. Good morning.
Here's some of that social curriculum that we embed into our practice. So what makes a good friend? How about Casey?
When somebody, falls, like, in the playground and, you get bumped in your head, somebody, makes them a card, or, they, like, help people go to the nurse.
Go. Go. Hurrying help. Hurrying help.
This, their day, it's barely begun. We still have a whole reader's workshop block. We have a whole writer's workshop block, and we have a whole math block, as well as word study in the end to fit in. So as you can see, the academics that goes on is pretty intense and rigorous.
I know my ABCs. Next time, won't you sing with me?
I can name them out for you.
You can name them too.
And this hour in The Exchange, we learn our ABCs about early education, how and when and where it's most helpful, and for what types of kids. Let's hear from you, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Kristen Barden, who we just heard in that piece, kindergarten teacher at Beach Street School for the past decade. Kristen, thank you for taking time out of the classroom to be with us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Katie Brissett, Deputy Director of Early Learning NH, a nonprofit that advocates for early learning programs such as childcare, Head Start, and preschool. Katie, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Mary Eric. She's Administrator of the Bureau of Integrated Programs for the New Hampshire Department of Education, Director of Title I. She was formerly a researcher with a background in early childhood ed. And Mary, good to meet you too. Thank you for being here.
Wonderful to be here.
Well, and Mary, so let's talk about some of that research in early childhood ed. We've talked a lot this week about the young brain, what it needs for normal development. What's the connection between that social development, intellectual development, emotional development, and early learning?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. It really comes down to warm, nurturing relationships. Children need to feel safe, loved, and when they do, they become confident, curious, trusting. They can problem solve. They can engage in relationships with other children. And this is what will nurture their learning and understanding. Critical and foundational to this, though, is talking to children, talking over dinner, talking on walks, making observations. These interactions with adults in their environment and with their friends, kids in the neighborhood, on the same street, these are the things that are going to really encourage them to want to learn more and become self-reliant.
So when you talk about the first thing you mentioned was relationships, caring, warmth. So why early education, Mary? Why not just a nice daycare center?
Well, part of this also is understanding that there are challenges for certain communities. There's incoming equity in certain communities. And so sometimes for families, it's difficult to have the time to talk and go on observation walks and providing materials such as books that are very expensive. So what happens is if you have an environment where you can pool resources, so different children can come together, share resources with an educator who is very intentional, who understands the value of play, who understands the value of interactions and relationships, but also understands how to integrate vocabulary, mathematics, science, all the different things that the child will need as they transition into more formal education.
And before we go too much further, Katie, I would like to ask you, what do we mean exactly by early learning? Because we got an email from a mom earlier this week who felt that her stay-at-home experience with her daughter made her daughter more than ready for kindergarten. She talked about all the enrichment activities she did with her child, going to the library and so forth. And she seemed to feel a little bit insulted that early learning is often automatically associated with preschool and kindergarten.
So when we say early learning, or sometimes it's called early childhood education, it does mean these child care, Head Start, and preschool programs that a lot of kids attend. But it can also happen in the home. We do know that the vast majority of kids under six have both parents in the workforce, so a lot of times they are in these programs. But when you talk about brain development and brain architecture starting from the ground up, and it, like Mary said, it is about these relationships that can happen at home. It's just for, I think, the majority of kids, it does happen in more structured programs.
So the vast majority of little kids have two parents in the workplace.
Correct.
So they are almost by necessity going to some sort of outside-the-home structured environment.
That's right.
I'm interested in what you said about brain architecture, structure, building. I'd love a little bit more on that.
Right. So if you think of how a house is built from the ground up, you really want to make sure that the foundation is sturdy and not shaky. And we know that in brain architecture, the same thing happens. So these first 5 years, it's sort of this magic time where neural connections, these are happening at a rapid pace. And that's why we want to make sure these environments where these children are good experiences and great places for kids.
So what makes for a strong architecture, a strong foundation?
Well, it's things like, you know, relationships. That's probably the most important, having good teachers and adults and caregivers and talking to kids. There's this serve and return that happens, this sort of back and forth. We're not just sitting a child down and talking to them anymore. We're really engaging them and talking with them. and involving them in all these experiences.
Yeah, and Kristen, again, given your experience as a kindergarten teacher, you know, you said right in that piece, learning isn't just about numbers and letters. What else do you see your kindergartners learning beyond, look, I can count to 10 or I can count to 50?
So in the classroom, we do try to develop socially on a daily basis. So some of the things that children engage in are some student-initiated or led instruction. They're asking good questions, clarifying misunderstandings. There's a lot of teamwork that goes on in the classroom. Children are able to take on some of the leadership roles. We have something called Star of the Day, so that gives them the chance to sort of shine and be in different positions of power. Just the theory and the thought that everybody in this class matters, that's at our morning meeting time. It's important that you're here, you're being heard, what you say matters, and we, you know, appreciate and respect that you're here. And just, you know, developing intrinsically motivated children, you know, I want you to learn this because I'd like you to be a lifelong learner.
You know, Jason Moon, our producer, who again visited you and your class, told me that Beach Street School in particular has a lot of kids who are transitioning in and out. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but, you know, roughly half the kids who start there go somewhere else. How do you work with that, with new kids constantly coming in and out of the classroom?
I think just really working hard on developing relationships with the new students, making them feel included in our classroom. We've worked hard to build that respect and rapport with the children, so they also are doing some of those engaging behaviors. They're having, you know, opening up their arms to new students and just remaining very consistent and concise in my practice. There's predictability. And so soon the new students are able to kind of feel welcomed into our community, and they're following along with that schedule and becoming active participants.
How, just roughly, how often do you see kids who don't speak English as a first language? Because I know at Beach Street School anyway, I'm not sure about your class, but at Beach Street, it's a lot of different languages. I think up to 20 different languages
are
spoken.
Yeah, I think they're, right now we're up to 20 different languages. So in my class this year, I have roughly, you know, 8 to 10 students that could speak another language. I have a low EL population in my class this year. So EL is a program that children qualify for if they are speaking English as their second language. And there's some testing that goes behind it. But in particular this year, I have, roughly between 8 or 10 students that could be bilingual.
All right. Well, we will talk a lot more after a short break about early education, what it means, who especially seems to need early education experiences. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-NHPR. Coming up, the education writer for The Atlantic joins us. Last fall, she wrote a piece on this topic titled The Case Against Universal Preschool. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. As part of our series this week, The First Decade, we're looking at early learning this hour in The Exchange, and let's hear from you what early learning looks like right now in the Granite State, what experiences benefit kids the most. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Mary Erick, again, looking at the research, what's happening with the young brain, why high-quality early education is so important, no matter where it happens, in the home or in a, some type of setting. You talked about the importance of kids being talked to. Why is that so important?
Well, the interactions that happen during conversations stimulate the brain. And so as we talked about with the brain architecture, this is spurring growth, development, curiosity. It's one of the most exciting times for young children. You know, What's going on culturally, though, across the nation and in New Hampshire, is that technology booms are interfering with these processes. I mean, how many times are we walking down the street in a store, and I see young children with their families, and rather than maybe talking to them about what they're observing, they might actually be looking at their phones. They're not doing this intentionally at all, but being cognizant that spending time interacting and talking is what the it's going to feed the brain. So this child, when they grow up, really are curious and own their own thinking. That's the importance of having conversations, not being talked at, but interactions. So talking with your child and then having your child respond and you responding back to your child.
So parents staring at their phones while they're with the kid at the park, that's not helping the brain develop in the way that it should.
No, but I also want to say that part of that is, you know, how things are advertised in our society. Sometimes people just aren't aware. And so if we just make them a little bit more aware of that, maybe then they'll think about it.
Did you want to jump in there too, Katie?
I don't think any parent wants to do it wrong. I think everyone wants their kid to grow up with the same opportunities. And so I don't think it's a purposeful thing, but it's something that we need to educate parents on and the public around it and increase this public awareness around the brain development.
Well, I have read that kids, especially even babies, really need to see the human face. They need to see the eyes widen in surprise,
That's
or they
right.
need to see how the mouth moves with different words. So there's something
right.
we're hardwired to understand looking at human faces.
Yeah, it's not just the language. It's also the gestures and the facial expressions, and they're learning from all of those pieces together.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we dig into early education this hour in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. With us now on the line is Aaliyah Wong. She's education writer for The Atlantic. Her story that ran in The Atlantic Online in November was titled The Case Against Universal Preschool. And Aaliyah, it's great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, what is, first of all, Aaliyah, universal preschool? Does that mean that everybody has access to preschool or that everybody has to go just the way all kids need to go to first grade?
Well, it's actually the former. It is exactly what it sounds like. It's a preschool for all, and there's no obligation. I mean, I think in a number of states, there isn't even mandatory kindergarten, so to require preschool would be a little bit contradictory. But it essentially means expanding preschool access for every child, regardless of his or her family's ability to pay. And as we all know, preschool is extremely expensive, in some states even more pricey than the in-state tuition. So getting everyone in preschool is not an easy task.
So what's the case that you've heard, Aaliyah, against universal preschool?
Right. So the reason I wanted to do this story is because lately we've just been hearing a lot about universal preschool, especially in politics. It's a big buzzword among politicians, whether they're Republican or Democrat or independent. It's clearly an appealing term. So I wanted to kind of break it down and see what the reality is. And what I found, at least according to researchers, not all of them, but a huge bulk of them, is that while preschool, of course, does have its benefits, there's no denying that having those early education opportunities before preschool can really boost the child's success later in life. But the problem with this universal idea is that it might be a little bit like the cart before the horse, in that there really isn't enough funding to go around to give every child a seat in a preschool. And by pushing for this universal option, it could be minimizing the quality and the access for this kid to really need it. And research does show that these preschool opportunities can be particularly beneficial for kids who would otherwise be able to afford it because of the educational options they get to have, like expanding their vocabulary, things they wouldn't necessarily have in their home setting. So it's just about ensuring that we start with the neediest, and then maybe we can expand it.
So it's not so much anybody saying, Aaliyah, preschool is bad. It's that, you know, let's focus it where it seems to be needed most. Is that what you found out?
That's what I did find. And let me say that there are a big pool of people out there, researchers, politicians who do say explicitly that preschool isn't necessarily all that it's cut out to be, whether it's for low-income children or affluent children. There are people who say that the most beneficial experience is simply doing what was done in the olden days, whether it's playing at home, interacting with friends, socializing, maybe doing activities here and there. So preschool isn't an axiom in the sense that it's required for everyone. But if people do assume that it is good, the universal approach isn't necessarily the right answer at this point.
And Aaliyah, just hold on if you could, please. I want to bring our guests in studio into this. And Katie Brissett, to you first, what do you think? The idea that preschool maybe is oversold?
Again, I think these kids are going to be somewhere, and I think we need to just make sure that wherever they are is a great place. And she talked about the cost of it, and that is a huge part of it because we know that quality costs money. And unfortunately, the investment in that has not been what we need it to be in order to make all these places great.
You know, to you too, Mary, and Kristen, I'm going to fold you in too. Mary, I have read that some of these early education programs are beneficial to lower-income kids or disadvantaged kids who don't have some of the home opportunities that middle and upper-income kids have. But for the middle and the upper, nice but not necessary. What do you think?
Well, what it really comes down to is what opportunities are currently going on in the home. Even if you're middle or upper class, if both your parents are working, you may really benefit from being in that environment where you're interacting with other children the same age and that you're engaging in collaboration with other adults. So I don't necessarily think that. But what the research is very clear on is that young children who come from high economic challenges and families with economic challenges typically will come into kindergarten knowing approximately half the words that a child from an upper to upper middle class home does. Knowing that, I think it's really important for access and equity that there are opportunities for high quality experiences for young children.
Well, and to you, Kristen, in your kindergarten class, what differences do you see among kids who've been to preschool versus those who have not?
Some of the general things are that children are more comfortable taking risks. Generally, they have a higher pre-reading skill set, pre-math skill set. They have more experience with problem solving, and they have some skills that can help them self-regulate and self-motivate. They're able to work cooperatively with their peers. So in general, I do see some of those things.
Some of those what they call learn-to-learn skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aaliyah, you said if preschool has been oversold, who is overselling it?
I don't know if it's necessarily been oversold per se. I think just the priorities may be distorted. But it's funny because when I started reporting on preschool, I thought, oh, this is just, you know, such a simple slice of the pie when I'm reporting on education. You know, I have to write about Common Core and standards, all these other really controversial things. But I have to say I have never encountered something so political, so vexed as reporting on early education.
Really? Why is that?
That is something I'm still trying to discover. I think there's just a lot of stakes involved, and I think maybe it's somewhat of a new world that people are delving into, the fact that preschool may be a key part of this education pipeline. But I think there is a lot of money involved, too. It's not like the K-12 system where it's, well, you have the private and public sector, but with the public K-12 system, that's pretty much simple. It's a public school system. With pre-K, very few states are fully public with their preschool systems. A lot of times it's a combination of public subsidies and private funding, whether it's from the families themselves or from grants. So I think there's a lot of money involved, and whenever there's money, of course, there are passionate people and high stakes. Also, it's just very political. It's you have governors across the country really vying for this and really gaining a lot of critics because of these initiatives. I'm from Hawaii, and when I was a reporter there, And just last year, there was a constitutional amendment proposal that would have changed the Constitution to allow basically private funds to go to preschools or public preschool systems, or public funds to go to private preschool systems, because there wasn't any public school system there. And it became almost a separation of church and state issue, because a lot of private preschools are inherently run by churches, by religious organizations, or what have you. There was concern that there would be too much of a blurring between those lines. I've had researchers, some who support universal preschool, others who don't, who basically have me in the middle of their battles, calling me back and forth, trying to defend.
Who knew, Aaliyah?
I know it's such a it was such a surprising facet of this reporting. It makes it interesting, and it does go to show that there's a lot at stake other than 3 and 4 year olds. It almost becomes a battle over money and politics rather than children.
Okay. Well, Aaliyah Wong, thank you so much for giving us time out today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Aaliyah Wong, education reporter for The Atlantic. You can look at her article online. It's called The Case Against Universal Preschool. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Before we follow up on some of the points that Aaliyah made, all of you, I do want to go to our listeners. And Trish is waiting in Bridgewater. So hi, Trish. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thank you. I am a mom of a 5-year-old, and my son has been in preschool for the last 2 years, and he just had his kindergarten testing to enter in the fall. And I was astounded by the things that they were expecting of these kids and to see what level they were at, things that I never would have thought a 5-year-old could do was really amazing.
Well, like what?
They were testing not only letters and numbers, but counting and recognition, and how much could they read, how much could they write. You know, I used to think kindergarten was to learn reading and writing, but the expectation of knowing that going into kindergarten was very surprising to me.
Did you think like it was too much, Trish, or were you happy that it was so rigorous? What do you think?
Well, our school board just passed to have all-day kindergarten starting in the fall, so my son will be the first class do the all-day kindergarten. And I was ecstatic, because I think they need that edge. I think there's, on a global level, where the United States is at, that we need every advantage and every edge that our children can have.
Okay. Trish, thank you very much. I think that's for you first, Kristen. You did talk earlier about some parents might be surprised at how rigorous kindergarten is. It's not just, finger paints.
Yeah, so we have definitely over the years changed into a more rigorous and academic program. And so we at our school are given professional development on a consistent basis in literacy and math. And we are always, you know, in the classroom doing our best to meet those standards and meet their diverse needs and as well as meeting the standards.
Well, and this gets back into the research, Mary. I have read some research that says, you know, play is really important. Don't blow off play and think that it's just something fun. That's where kids do a lot of learning, too.
You're exactly right.
Are we going overboard with this academic rigor in kindergarten?
Well, I think it's really about thinking about what's really going on. Well-prepared teachers who understand project-based learning and inquiry can fold these expectations into a program that is very engaging and exciting for young children. And they're very capable and confident. They will be able to work through that with them.
So they will be able to allow for enough play and keep up with the standards that our caller mentioned. That's a tall order.
No, but what inquiry is play. And I don't know if everyone really understands that. So when we hear...
It doesn't sound like it.
Well, inquiry is playing with ideas, playing with language, playing with concepts. It is play. And if it's approached in a professional way, and that's how the educators here in New Hampshire are doing it, then confident and capable students will exit kindergarten.
Katie, I'd love to hear from you on this too.
Yeah, we want to ensure that it's developmentally appropriate. So I think and New Hampshire is doing a good job to really meet the children where they're at rather than expect them to all come to school at the same level. And a lot of that happens in the early years, whether, you know, if they're at these early childhood programs, a lot of this preparation is taking place, although they're not, you know, sitting down doing flashcards on numbers and letters. They are learning through play. A lot of that happens there.
You know, Aaliyah mentioned something else, the high cost for some families of high quality preschool. How do families pay, Katie, for preschool if they can't just, you know, afford it out of pocket? And I really, you know, it's been a little while since my kids are in preschool. Can you give us a sense also of just how much, the range of how much it costs?
I might be able to. First, you know, New Hampshire does have the child care scholarship system. And so parents up to 250% of the federal poverty level can qualify for assistance to afford child care.
So maybe not the whole bill, but part of it.
Exactly. And unfortunately, it does not cover a lot of the whole bill for a lot of quality programs. But it's great because it has this sort of stepping down process where they gradually can go off of assistance, which means they're more likely to stay off. But like you said, it doesn't always cover the whole cost. And for a lot of families, it's still out of reach.
So there's a subsidy, but it's not enough. Go ahead, Mary.
And also, what's happening currently in public education is that local school boards are supporting pre-Ks within the public school, and Title I is funding that. So right this year, $1.2 million has been awarded through the grants management system with the New Hampshire Department of Education to Title I schools who want preschool free. So access and equity for the students who need it the most.
So it's public preschool, basically, just like first grade, kindergarten. It's there in the school. It's paid for by taxpayers.
No, it is not. That's what I'm explaining to you. It's paid for by Title I federal funds and local school boards, not the Department of Education.
Local school
boards are deciding they want it, but they're being able to leverage Title I funds to open it up for their students.
Well, and just again on this issue of how much it costs, here's an email from Angie. She's right on target with this. She says, I signed my daughter up for preschool next year, and the cost is $800 a month for 7:30 to 3:30, 5 days a week. That $800 is due on the first of the month for 10 months. Angie says it is close to the mortgage payment. She says we will spend $24,000 on her preschool, in all caps, Angie says. She says, when are we supposed to save for college? Angie, thank you for that email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call as we talk about early education in New Hampshire. It's part of our series this week, The First Decade. Coming up, NHPR education reporter Sam Evans-Brown will be with us talking about the debate over half-day versus full-day kindergarten. All that's coming up. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. As part of NHPR's series this week, The First Decade, we're looking this hour at early education, both kindergarten and pre-K. With us now is NHPR education reporter Sam Evans-Brown. He's been looking at the kindergarten issue here in the Granite State. And Sam, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, what does public kindergarten look like right now in New Hampshire? Because it's a little different from some states.
Well, so we were the last state in the country to make public kindergarten mandatory for school districts to provide it. Half-day kindergarten is all that's required. There are a number of towns, though, quite a few at this point, that have chosen to expand to full-day kindergarten of their own volition and are paying for it themselves.
What's the breakdown, roughly, Sam, of those who do and those who don't?
So we're up to about 60% of school districts that are providing it. That's lower than in other parts of the country. Census-based study of how many kids are kindergarten-age kids are actually attending kindergarten, done by EdWeek, found that 75% nationwide is the average. So back in their data is from the census, so it's a few years old. So 2013, we were 49th in the nation for the number of kids actually attending full-day kindergarten.
Still, 60% attending full-day. That's a big change.
It's more than before. That's certainly the case. I mean, 1999 is when towns first started providing this, and we've seen just sort of a gradual growth, 5 towns per year on average adding full-day programs.
Wow. And Mary, did you want to add into that picture that Sam's painted for us?
In addition to that, what we've done at the New Hampshire Department of Ed is we've conducted a survey, and what we've found out is that 73% to 80% of our schools could have full-day kindergarten if some of our districts could solve space and funding issues. But they're actually working on it. So we are looking at an increase in the next several years.
That's a big if, though, isn't it? Space and funding. I mean, there's always battles over where to spend local tax dollars.
Absolutely. But we're also leveraging federal funds. And we really need to keep that in mind. Even some of these full-day kindergartens, the taxpayer is not paying for some of them. Some of them are being funded through federal dollars. So there's a little more to the story.
Sam?
So I was just going to say that typically on a town level, those two questions, space and funding, tend to be crucial. And a lot of towns will tell you that the towns that if you look at which towns have expanded, they tend to be sort of overwhelmingly on the western and northern part of the state. And towns will tell you that part of what's going on here, those are the areas that are losing population the most, enrollments are declining, that opens up space in the classroom. And rather than lay off a teacher who's been there for years, you can just hang on to that teacher and fill a classroom that otherwise is going to be empty, so the budget impact is minimal for those schools. And that's part of the story for why it's been easier for those towns to expand.
Okay. And a question for you before we go to our listeners. Kristen, you do full-day kindergarten. How would you do it if you were doing half-day? I'm just trying to imagine how you would do all that you do in that. Well, it's really not even – I mean, half-day to most people means 3 or 4 hours. It's really more like 2.5 hours in Concord anyway, so –
So I think that it would be a give and take, and I wouldn't maybe have the opportunities that I have now to promote some of that social growth because the standards have become so rigorous. So I think it's very challenging for teachers in the state that have half-day programs to meet their needs.
Is Manchester – because Concord is half-day. Is Manchester half-day or full-day?
Our school has been full-day since I've been there. And currently, the city of Manchester has just provided full-day kindergarten for all students. And I believe our superintendent was very proactive in having that come to fruition. So.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Brian is joining us from Dover. Hi, Brian. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling. I hear a lot about this childhood education, which is great. I have a 3.5-year-old, but I'm really concerned that everything is moving away from this, like, this classroom is talking about being more rigorous and whatnot. I want more play in the classroom, and that doesn't seem to be happening anymore. It seems like play is being unserviced, you know, from preschool on up, and I think we need to have children playing more than less.
It's definitely a concern, and we talked about it a little bit ago, but Katie, I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well.
Thanks for the question, Brian. And I also think it's important to remember that there's a variety of places that are good for kids, and a lot of times it does happen in the school because there's open space and there's teachers available. But a lot of the community-based programs are just as good and if not better for some kids. You know, this play, this open space, you know, time for the outdoors, a lot of that can't always happen in the public school setting.
Go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say that a lot of teachers will tell you that the standards have risen regardless of the amount of time that they're allotted to meet those standards. So if you look at half-day programs, when you look at what gets squeezed out in order to meet those standards, it often is time to do play, to do free choice that kids are given. So a lot of teachers will say once you expand a full day, they're very thankful that they're able to give students more time to do that, the sort of free choice time and to develop their social skills in that way.
Well, and Mary, I have a question for you. Anyone jump in too? There's a lot of research out there on this, some of it more reliable or rigorous than others. But I did come across some studies that said that kids who sort of had too much forced on them all at once, as they went along in elementary school, they didn't learn as well because, as our caller says, their brains just didn't have that time to rest, relax, integrate everything that they were encountering.
Well, we're
actually doing ourselves a disservice by this.
I absolutely understand where you're coming from with that question. But what we have to really think about is it's the role of the educator to meet the child where they are. It is not the role of the child to meet an expectation. So the real key to this is if you have well-prepared educators who understand they need to meet the child where they are and individualize, then you will not get into that situation. I also want to say that I go in and out of schools all over the state in my role as the director of Title I, and I see play-based, project-based learning all over New Hampshire. Those are the programs that are meeting the expectations, those high expectations, in a developmentally appropriate manner. So we also need to understand that some myths are being created around public education due to maybe one or two programs someone happened to see.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Okay, and Sam, again, speaking of research, there's a bazillion studies out there about the possible benefits of full day, kindergarten versus half day. Break that down for us, if you could, Sam. You know, what are some of the arguments that people on the half day side are making?
So I'd say that the big argument that folks on the half day side make is that it's just not a cost effective intervention, because by about grade four, other students start to catch up. I would say that that is somewhat of a disingenuous argument, because students who do attend full day kindergarten, it's pretty clear that if you're looking at just their test scores for those 3 years, they're way ahead of their peers. And the question is, Are those other kids, are we seeing the benefit of full day kindergarten fading out? Or are we seeing the other students catching up? I think it's a much more plausible story that the other students are catching up. And when you say that, then what's going on? What you're seeing is teachers having to remediate the students who are in half day programs. And so if you have students in full day programs, there's less remediation that's having to happen. But at the same time, there's another literature that exists side by side, beside the one that's looking strictly at test scores, which is looking at life outcomes for students who attend these early education programs. And that's, you see higher high school graduation rates, higher college attendance rates, and higher lifetime earnings. So it could be that, while we are seeing a fade out in test scores, it could be that there are other benefits, perhaps, for instance, learning how to interact with other kids that aren't quite captured in just the test score data.
Yeah, Katie, we do hear this, that some of the benefits that kids get early on seem to dissipate by grade three or four. But Sam's saying it's a little more nuanced than that. What do you think?
That's right. There was some research around Head Start and the concern that, it fades out, so it's not worth investing. But Sam's absolutely right. It's not a matter of those kids fading out. It's the other kids eventually catch up so that they're all on the same playing field.
Did you want to jump in on there too? Kristen, I know you haven't worked in a half day versus full day, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this issue.
I think that talking about play is an interesting topic, because some people may perceive it as, not important. But really, when children are playing, it's teaching them to persevere, how to control themselves, how to keep their attention. And so those other skills are all happening. And the teacher is engaged in that play. I'm not just, correcting papers while children are on the ground doing silly play. There is some intentional teaching behind the play. So in my experience, I think that having that opportunity, having supportive principals in your school that recognize that children are learning through their play, and that there is some deep thinking going on and some higher level skills taking place, I just think that it's important. Yeah.
One of the other arguments I've heard against full day kindergarten is that 5-year-olds are just, it's too much. It's too long a day. They're wiped out, and that, 2.5-3 hours is enough.
So, like Mary said, that becomes my job and my challenge to be able to help the children find the stamina to be able to push through that day. So having developmentally appropriate practices keeps them engaged and ready and wanting to learn. And it is a difficult experience for our kindergartners coming to school for the first time. They are tired. They do miss their mom, and they are going through all these transitions. But I just think that it helps to prepare them.
Yeah, I remember my boys. I'm smiling because I remember my boys transitioned from preschool to kindergarten. They said, "Mom, no more naps."
No more naps.
And that was a little bit of a struggle. Did you want to jump in there, Sam?
I was just going to say, having talked to a number of preschool kindergarten teachers for this story, a lot of them will say kids are going to go through that transition at some point, regardless.
Absolutely.
And so the question is, do you do it at the beginning of first grade, or do you do it at the beginning of kindergarten? And for a few months, they say, yes, it is hard for them to make it through the full day, but then they adapt.
Katie, did you want to jump in? And then we'll go back to our listeners.
I just wanted to add, what's the alternative? If kids aren't there all day, where are they going? If they can't afford this quality after school program, a lot of them could be going home alone or in not so great places. So that's another argument there.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Julie's in Concord. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. My daughter's in a half-day program and then gets on a bus and goes to her aftercare program, which is a great program. And the teachers are doing an excellent job in both. But I noticed that some of the kids who are having some behavior problems or maybe a lack of consistency at home struggle with that transition during the day. So the day teachers have a set of expectations and rules and work with the kids in a certain way. And then they get on the bus, go to another program, and there are new teachers, new rules, new expectations, new kids. So this transition, so they're still in school all day, which is great, and they do well with the length of time, but I think the change in expectations is hard on these kids.
Yeah, you're right. That is a big transition. I guess I'll turn to you, Mary, I think. You know, two whole different sets of kids, two different places, two sets of teachers. It's a lot of transition and change for a five-year-old.
I'm going to go back to what I said in the opening of the show. It's about relationships, building strong, caring, safe relationships. So the more transitions a young person has to go through, it's going to make it more difficult for them to build those trusting relationships, to be confident and competent as they move forward.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Julie, thank you for that one. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Wendy's in Portsmouth. Hi, Wendy. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling today from the Seacoast Media Group. We're doing a project with United Way to put 1,000 backpacks full of kindergarten readiness materials in the hands of parents of low-income children who are headed into kindergarten in the fall. So we're really excited to think about being able to put these materials in their hands and think about how it can support exactly what you've been talking about this morning, social-emotional readiness, writing skills, reading skills. They're getting books from Heinemann Publishing, and we have 100 volunteers here today, but there have been thousands of people in the local community who have contributed materials to go into these backpacks.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling in, Wendy. So a community effort over there on the seacoast. Thanks for letting us know about that. You know, Sam, getting back to the issue of money, it's easy to say that, yes, districts should expand to full-day kindergarten. Mary explained to us that there are some federal funds involved, but this does cost money. Easier said than done for some school districts.
Yeah, and the dollar amount that it costs a district, again, as I said before, for some districts, it's an easier lift because the space is available. For some of the more crowded districts down in the southern part of the state or on the seacoast, for instance, it can be a lot more expensive. New Market, for instance, put it at somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000 to expand their program. So it can be quite expensive. There was actually a bill before the legislators this year that would have expanded. It wouldn't have made full day mandatory, but it would have paid for on a per pupil basis for schools to expand to full day kindergarten. It included a number of other things. So this isn't just kindergarten, but that bill was going to cost $2.1 million to do that statewide. So it's money is an issue, and that bill is on the table right now, and it's largely because there wasn't space for it in the budget.
Let's take one more call. This is Willow in Springfield, Vermont. Hi, Willow. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Thank you so much. This is a really incredible discussion, and a lot of really great points have been brought up. And I just wanted to put in point about the worker support aspect of having full-day preschool and kindergarten programs, because as someone mentioned, the children being sort of bussed around between here and there, and the parents are doing it too. Even middle-class families are engaging in this shuffle to try and be able to keep their jobs and get their kids where they need to go, because not everyone has access to school buses and things like that. So people have to take time off of work and bring their children from here to there.
Yeah, in fact,
I don't think it's good for anyone. It's a worker support issue.
Yeah, I think you had a parent in your story this morning, Sam, right, who had to leave work, pick up her child, bring her to an aftercare program because they weren't ready-made buses.
Yeah, and there are families for whom that's not a problem. There are folks who are still staying at home, for instance. But it's 70% of parents in New Hampshire are both parents are working at this point, or if it's a single family, that parent is working. So it's we're in a different society now, and the idea that you can expect someone to be at home is just not a sure thing.
Yeah, Mary gave us those numbers at the top. 70%. Do you think most people? Oh, you did, Katie. Okay. Do you think most people realize the extent to which parents of young kids, both parents, are working? I was surprised that it was that high.
Yeah, I don't think people realize it. And I think it's because it's different. It's new and change takes time to really understand. So it's surprising for a lot of people.
All right. Well, a lot more we could have dug into this hour. I want to thank everybody for being here. Sam, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Laura.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's education reporter. Kristen Barden, thank you again for leaving your kindergarten kids and coming in today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Kristen Barden, kindergarten teacher at Beach Street School in Manchester. By the way, you can listen to the full piece by Jason Moon visiting Kristen's class at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Katie Brissett, good to meet you. Thank you for being here. Katie Brissett, Deputy Director of Early Learning New Hampshire, and Mary Eric, thank you also for being here.
Thank you.
Mary Eric, she's with the New Hampshire Department of Education and State Director of Title I. You can check out nhpr.org for lots of material, including charts and maps, and a report entitled New Hampshire Doesn't Fund Preschool Programs but Tracks Slightly Ahead in Attendance. All that's at our website, nhpr.org. Lots of reporting and more information as part of our series this week, The First Decade. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy.